Welcome to A Minute to Midnight with Chris.
And Tony.
Tony, it's been another up and down, topsy-turvy ride in markets across the board.
Oh, absolutely. Yep, we're certainly seeing a lot of volatility in all areas, aren't we?
And we've got a great guest today, Michael Snyder.
Really looking forward to that interview.
And he's going to give us a bit of a rundown on that front. So without further ado, let's get into this interview with Michael Snyder.
Okay, so we have our guest, Michael Snyder of the economiccollapseblog.com, and we welcome you to A Minute to Midnight. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, thank you, Tony. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, it's awesome. I'm really glad to have you on the show, and I'm pretty sure we'll have a lot to discuss. Well, I know we've got a lot to discuss, and I'm really looking forward to the information that you bring out and the answers to some of our questions. So I will actually hand you over to Chris first, and Chris has got a few things that he wants to ask.
That's great. I look forward to getting some questions from Chris.
Yeah, hi, Mike.
Hi.
Good to hear from you. It's cold up there, I gather.
Oh, yeah, we've got snow on the ground. It's a little chilly, so I'm a little jealous of you guys down in New Zealand. I imagine it's summertime down there, and you guys are having some nice weather, I'd imagine.
Yeah, we're having some brilliant weather at the moment. I'm not sure how your scale works, but we're around the late 20s here.
Late 20s Celsius, that's about 80 or so Fahrenheit.
Yeah, so much happening in the economic zone at the moment. So many things are transpiring. I just want to ask you, firstly, you wrote an article on the Economic Collapse blog, which is yours.com, and you mentioned the market meltdown in 2016. Could you just give us a bit of a quick overview on that on that article you wrote?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we've seen so far in 2016, at least through the first 20 days or so, for global markets as a whole, it was the worst start to a year we've ever seen in all of modern history for the stock markets. And so, it's been very, very unusual in which it's like January 1st came and someone just hit the accelerator. You know, the year started off, and the Chinese markets, first trading day of the year, emergency shutdown. And then just a few days later, another emergency shutdown where their markets were totally shut down after they had declined a total of 7% on each day. You know, we've seen the price of oil completely collapse. At one point, the price of U.S. oil was around $27 a barrel. And then just last Wednesday, less than a week ago, there were big headlines on CNBC all over the world, which declared global markets enter bear market. And so the global stocks had entered a bear market for the first time since the last great financial crisis. And what that means is that basically about 20% or about one quarter of all stock market wealth in the world is already gone. We've only got 4/5 left that haven't been totally wiped out. So that, if that sounds like a pretty big deal to people, that is a pretty big deal. And of course, this didn't just start on January 1st. In fact, if you go back to June 2015, basically the last 6 months of 2015 and then the very beginning now of 2016, over that time period, more than $15 trillion of stock market wealth has been wiped out around the world.
Wow, that's a lot. What would you say to listeners who are invested in the stock market, what they should do?
Well, it's not my role to give out specific financial advice. I'm not a licensed financial advisor, and so I'm not telling people to do this with their stocks or that with their stocks, but I'm just presenting the information. My wife and I personally, if the stock market goes down, we're not going to lose one penny. And a lot of people have already lost a tremendous amount of money, not only in stocks, which we've already covered, but junk in bonds. Bonds have been crashing, particularly junk bonds. People are losing a lot of money there. Oil has crashed. Commodities have crashed. And, you know, with all of these things, you know, and perhaps we can talk about these if you guys would like, but we're seeing so many of the exact same patterns that happened just before the stock market crash of 2008 are happening again right now. So if I was to create basically a scenario for a textbook that would kind of set the, you know, of what the run-up to a major financial crisis would look like. Well, all the boxes are checked. You know, all the, so many of the things that we saw last time around are happening again. And so if people got burned last time, well, they should see the signs because all of them are playing out again and take whatever appropriate action that they feel is best for them and their family.
Right. What's your view on what's going on in Europe at the moment with the banking system? I've been reading some articles recently regarding the Italian banks. What's your view on that?
Yeah, you know, well, you know, over the past few years, Greece has made so many headlines around the world. You know, and Europe had such a hard time, you know, coming up with a bailout for Greece. Well, Greece is the 44th largest economy on the entire planet. Italy is the 8th largest economy on the planet. And now, since the beginning of the year, Italian stocks have been crashing, particularly Italian bank stocks. Basically, all the major banking stocks have been crashing. And now some newspapers are saying a run on the banks in Italy has begun. People are pulling their money out. They're scared they might get caught by a bail-in or multiple bail-ins at these different Italian banks. And so the economy, the Italian economy and financial system have been crumbling and shaking for quite some time. And I've been telling my readers to watch Italy, but now we're starting to see it really, really start to unravel. And there's concern that because what these banks in Italy, some of them, about a third of all their loans are bad loans, meaning they're probably never going to be repaid. So, you know, these banks are drowning under, you know, just a huge load of bad debt, bad loans that they've made. And, you know, many of them are basically insolvent at this point. And so kind of the watch is out in terms of the countdown to when one or more of the largest banks in Italy are going to start failing, and then what's going to happen. You know, of course, January 1st, the new bail-in rules went into effect in Europe. And what that says is if a major bank fails, well, what happens first is they go after the bondholders and the shareholders. But then after that, if there's still more money required to rescue the bank, well, then they come after people with large bank accounts. And so this is something we saw in Cyprus back in 2013. And what happened in Cyprus has now been used as the template for these new rules, which just went into effect on January 1st all over Europe. So people in Italy are concerned that they could get caught, you know, in the situation where their money is going to be taken to bail out these banks. And so that's a major, major concern.
Yes, we as depositors are seen as a liability, and we're going to get hit big time if we've got money in the bank. That's what you're saying, isn't it? Or those that, particularly in Italy at this stage, their deposits are at real risk.
Yeah, I mean, the idea behind some of these new rules that have been put in over in Europe is that bank accounts are basically unsecured liabilities. And so, most people, have just always assumed all this time, if you put your money in the bank, it's your money. It's always going to be there. You can go get it whenever you want. But, you know, the way these new rules frame it is that, no, you're an unsecured, you know, creditor. And you've just got to get, you know, when things fall apart, you've got to get in line just like everyone else. And if a bail-in is required, those that have money over a certain amount, whether it's over 100,000 euros or whatever else, well, your money could get taken to bail the bank out. Then what you get in return is some shares in the bank, potentially, which, you know, for an insolvent bank are could be essentially worthless. But, you know, a lot of people are concerned because, you know, these new rules and then, of course, once a crisis strikes, like we saw in Cyprus, the rules can change almost overnight during a major, major crisis. So Yeah, a lot of, not only just in Italy, but all over Europe, banks are incredibly shaky, over-leveraged. They're in danger of going under. And so people need to watch what's going on over in Europe, and as particularly with the banking system, very, very carefully.
So do you see contagion possibly taking place?
Oh, yeah, and not just in Europe, but all over the world, you know, because our global financial system is more interconnected than ever. You know, when we just saw how at the beginning of the year, the kind of panic in China just spread everywhere almost instantly all over the world. And then, you know, different banks, you know, across continents are tied together. They've, you know, lent money to one another, or they're tied together through derivatives contracts. And so, you know, the Bank for International Settlements has estimated there's somewhere around $600 trillion of these derivatives contracts all over the world. And many are just between one financial institution and another. And, you know, so I compare it to dominoes. When you know, one or two or three dominoes start to go down, it could really take down the entire, virtually the entire system very, very rapidly.
How does one protect oneself from this when it happens?
Well, in terms of protecting yourself, one thing that my wife and I say, we're big believers in not having all of your eggs in one basket. So a lot of people, they have all their money and they have it in one, you know, bank account, or they have it, you know, it all in their stock market portfolio or whatever. But we believe in spreading our money and assets around a bunch of different places. Now, that's certainly not a perfect solution, but at least it helps minimize your risk. So if you've got one bank account, maybe have two or three. You know, if you've got, you know, one type of investment, maybe consider spreading that around. And then I do believe in having at least a little bit of cash, not all of your money, but a little bit of cash at home in case the ATMs go down. There's some kind of banking holiday in case, you know, there's a problem with your bank or the banking system as a whole. Well, you still got at least some cash at home. You can pay the bills. You can go out, get food for your family, whatever you need to do. I think those are some common sense principles. Another thing that I recommend is, you know, if you remember back in 2008, at least here in the United States, all of a sudden things started to get crazy. And panic and fear started to spread, and the banks didn't want to lend to each other. They didn't want to lend to anyone else. All of a sudden, there was a credit crunch, which is a big deal because in our system, you know, we use debt and credit for everything. To get buy a house, to buy a car, we use our credit cards for everything. So when credit freezes up, well, that really slows economic activity down. And so, you know, if you know, just like in 2008, you know, if you own a business or you work at a business, you'll notice maybe fewer people are coming in. If the people who do come in, they have less money to spend. And so then we're going to see businesses cut back, start to lay off workers. And because most Americans, 63% of all Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Well, last time around in 2008, all of a sudden millions of people lost their jobs and they couldn't pay the mortgage because they're living right on the edge. And millions went from living a comfortable middle-class lifestyle to being essentially out on the street very, very rapidly. So I fear that the same thing is going to happen once again. So I encourage people to have an emergency fund, you know, where of at least 6 months expenses that can cover everything you need, whether it's your mortgage, your rent, your bills, your food, whatever you need for at least 6 months. So that's another kind of common sense thing for people that I would recommend.
What about precious metals? Are you a fan of gold and silver?
We are. My wife are a fan of gold and silver, but it's something we don't recommend people do. But they need to take care of other things first. You know, you've got to have your emergency fund. Another thing is, my wife and I believe in storing up emergency food and supplies. We don't think we're going to need them next week or next month, but down the road where we're heading, I believe that we are going to need that. But once you've got kind of your basics and your other preparations done, then you have money left over and you want to protect your wealth for the longer term. We do really love gold and silver, particularly silver. I mean, silver has been hovering around $14 an ounce. I mean, just insanely undervalued and underpriced. And then, and gold is underpriced too. But when you look at the ratio of gold and silver, historically it's been closer to, 10 to 1 or 12 to 1. Now it's like over 60 to 1, even more than that now recently. But, but basically gold and silver comes out of the ground about and gold and silver, it's a ratio of about 10 to 1 or 12 to 1. Other people use slightly different numbers, but in terms of the amount of it that's actually out there. And then silver is constantly being used up in all kinds of industrial applications, while gold isn't because it's too expensive. So my wife and I particularly believe that silver is massively undervalued, and that those, especially those that are come in now and get at $14 an ounce, in the long term are going to be extremely happy with their investment in silver.
I'll hand you over to Tony. He can ask you some more questions. I'll come back with some after him again. But good talking to you, Michael. Here's Tony.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm encouraged to hear that many of the things that we've been suggesting, you're also sort of encouraging the gold and silver thing, particularly silver, we're very keen on here. And the need to store food is a biggie. And water, we believe that storing water is a real big thing that we need to be either storing water or having a way of purifying water. That's a big one. But moving on to another question, do you think that the collapsing of global economies is a result of mismanagement of global finances due to incompetence on the part of banksters, politicians, etc.? Or do you think those that set up the debt-based financial system, like the Federal Reserve banksters, thought they could get away with these pyramid schemes and manipulations forever? Or, alternatively, do you believe that this is in fact a carefully orchestrated plan by the elite to collapse their own financial system in order to bring about a new financial system as a result?
That's a very interesting question. In terms of their motives, I think when the Federal Reserve was first created, back in 1913, certainly greed was at the heart of it, and the elite want to enslave the entire world, and one of the best and easiest ways to do that is through debt. And so the size of the U.S. national debt has gotten more than 5,000 times larger since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. And since that time, of course, this system, this debt-based Ponzi scheme pyramid system, has expanded all over the world. And today, well over 99% of the population of the world lives in a country that has a central bank is similar to the Federal Reserve, and there's a few countries that aren't, North Korea probably being the most prominent example, but basically the whole world is under this debt-based system, and this debt-based system basically systematically transfers wealth from all of us to the elite. And so, for example, Oxfam just came out with a new report. And if you go back, and according to their numbers, if you go back to 2010, 388 members of the global elite had as much wealth as the bottom half of all humanity combined. But now fast forward to today, and that number has gone down to 62. Just 62 members of the global elite have as much money as the entire poorest half of all humanity, about 3.6 billion people combined. And what Oxfam found is the elite are getting wealthier very, very rapidly. Meanwhile, the poorest half of humanity has actually gotten significantly poorer. And so, the system, basically the whole world uses, it transfers money from governments and everyone else that they trap in their debt schemes, systematically transfers money and wealth from all the rest of us to them. So they keep getting wealthier, we keep getting poorer. And then, of course, the corporations that they own just keep getting bigger and more powerful and become even more dominant over the global system. And so today, you know, just the average person on the street has very, very little power compared to these, the elite and their banks and their giant corporations. And that's not a good thing. And particularly here in the United States, where, you know, our founding fathers were suspicious of any large concentrations of power, government or otherwise. In fact, there were very, very, very tight restrictions on corporations in the early days of the United States, because what they didn't want power and wealth to get concentrated in, you know, any in one person or institution, but rather they wanted the balance of power to shift in the favor of individuals and individual rights and so forth. So I it's always hard to judge the exact motives of the elite, and but in terms of, you know, the effect that it's having, we can see it every day. But then I do believe that they like to create order out of chaos.
Yeah.
And so sometimes they'll come in and they'll actually play a big role in creating a problem,
yeah,
which will create a reaction. And then the solutions they always give us always mean more globalization, more centralization, more money and power in their own hands.
Yeah, you mentioned the rich elite that control the world and those with the most money. I find it really interesting that the Rothschilds never show up in that listen, yet I suspect that the Rothschild family probably has wealth more than all those other people that show up on that rich list. They're possibly a level above them again, but we probably shouldn't go down that rabbit trail today. So do you see us heading towards a totalitarian global government as a result of what's going on at the moment?
Oh, I very much do. I think, you know, during moments of crisis, the elite can advance their agenda much more than usual. And so I think they're looking forward to the moments of crisis that are coming. And I think they will use that to advance us toward a system of one world government, one world economy, one world religion even.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what they want, of course, with them controlling and running everything. So I think that's their goal. That's what they want. And the chaos that I believe that we're starting to move into and will accelerate greatly over the next few years, I believe that will be used to propel us in that direction.
Okay, then. So along with that, do you see us moving towards a cashless society? Have you been following that? And I'm wondering what your thoughts are in that direction.
Yeah, just over the last couple of days, the biggest bank in Norway came out and they said, you know what, we think that cash should be banned in Norway. We think that it should be totally done away with. You know, in fact, a lot of the big bank branches in Norway and in Sweden actually no longer deal in cash. They won't give out cash. They won't take cash. And almost everything is done electronically anyway. But, you know, for the biggest bank in Norway, DNB, that's not good enough for them. They say, well, let's just get rid of cash entirely, you know, and they say, oh, it'll help crack down on criminals and money launderers and people who are evading taxation. But, you know, but basically the goal is for these banks, they want everybody in the system. If no one can have cash, well, everyone's got to use the banks, and that's what they want, because then everyone has to be a customer of one of the banks. And then also they like it because of the, you know, they get their fees every time we swipe our card or whatever, they get a fee. And so they make more money. And so part greed is driving part of it. But then, of course, governments like the idea of a cashless society, too, because it enables them to watch and track and monitor us more closely. Basically, everything we do, they can kind of keep an eye on. You know, they really like that idea, too. You know, as the kind of the, it's all part of the Big Brother police state control grid that's going in all over the world. And so, you know, we were seeing this big push in China. They're talking about it. In India, they're trying to promote people to use cards and to move away from cash, even in a poor country like that. But it's the most aggressively being done in Europe, where nations such as Spain and Italy and France have already put a cap on cash transactions. In other words, you can do cash transactions up to a certain amount, but over that, it's completely banned. Or, you know, Denmark has a stated goal of eradicating cash by the year 2030. In Sweden, ATM machines have been pulled out by the thousands, as that country is already almost entirely cashless. In fact, if you go to church, you know, almost everyone gives money now through digitally, through electronic means, and even in their churches. So we're seeing this happen all over the world, this big push toward a cashless society. And to me, it's very, very potentially dangerous.
So, Michael, you were previously mentioning that, you know, it's good to take cash out of the system, but what you're just saying then is it's more the fact that they're trying to prevent a run on the banks. If and when, or should I say when, a collapse occurs, and by having a cashless society, then depositors will not be able to run to the banks and take out cash digitally, would be the only way to do it. But also when it comes to a bank bail-in, the banks have it's almost with surety guaranteed that they can raid your account. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that would absolutely be correct. And so, you know, having a cashless society is perfect for the banks in the event of a major crisis, because, you know, in the past, one of the things that has caused problems for the banks is that when a crisis comes, well, everyone wants to pull their money out of the banks. We saw the long lines just in Greece last year, you know, during those moments of crisis. And so the banks, you know, one way they can stop bank runs from ever happening is, say, hey, you know, everyone's got to have their money in the banks. And, you know, I guess you switch it from one bank to another, you know, so that, you know, that would still be there. But, you know, and then you were mentioning bail-ins, you know, where people, you know, if they've got to have all their money in the banks, well, that just creates a certain situation. And so, you know, that's kind of what we're facing. And, you know, once again, with the bank bail-ins, you could switch your money from one bank to another and have it in multiple banks, but most people don't bother to do that. So I think both of your points are very, very valid and are just a couple more reasons why banks are such in favor of this war on cash.
Thanks again for that. Coming back to my original question with where you think we're heading in 2016, do you see something major developing this year and possibly when?
Yeah, well, I believe that something major has already started. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we've already seen such huge losses. You know, I just saw an article the other day where Warren Buffett has lost $11 billion. Just Warren Buffett has lost $11 billion during this market meltdown alone. So I think this is already happening, you know, and so many of the exact same patterns we saw last time are happening again. So many of the red flags. And so, yeah, I don't, if people are waiting for the next financial crisis, I would say it's already here. You know, 1/5 of all global stock market wealth has already been wiped out. We only have 4/5 left. And so, you know, but a lot of people are still saying, oh, it's going to bounce back. It's going to be fine. But when will they wake up? When the total loss is 30%, 40%, half of all global stock market wealth? How far is it going to have to fall before people say, you know, this really is a crisis. It's really here. You know, sometimes, you know, we don't realize what we're happening until it's over. Then we can look back and see the total amount of damage that's done. But already, you know, Walmart here in the United States just announced closing of 269 stores. Global trade is collapsing all over the world. The Baltic Dry Index just dropped to an all-time low, even lower than during the last great financial crisis and global recession. You know, in fact, global trade has slowed down so much. There was just an article in Bloomberg that it's now cheaper to rent a 1,000-foot merchant vessel, you know, the kind that sails the oceans around the world, than it is to rent a Ferrari. That is how much global trade has slowed down, how global economic activity is already grinding to a halt. And so do I think things are going to get a whole lot worse? Oh, yeah. they're going to get worse than most people would even dare to imagine. But, you know, do we have to wonder about when is the next crisis coming? No, because it's already started. It already started in the second half of last year. So it's already here. The only question now is how bad is it ultimately going to be?
And how people should prepare for that, which you've already mentioned.
Yeah. People need to realize now's not the time to go out and get into a bunch of new debt to buy a bunch of shiny new toys, whether it's, you know, new cars, boat, this or that. Now's the time to batten down the hatches, reduce your expenses, maybe try to, increase your income a little bit by starting a side business or doing some extra work or, you know, whatever it is. But being lean and mean is really going to pay off in the times we're moving into.
Okay, hey, thanks again, Michael, and I'll hand you over to Tony.
Okay, sounds good.
What about agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the TTIP, these global sort of agreements and treaties that are being signed at the moment? Like New Zealand is involved in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which seems to be Obama's big baby that he's pushing. How do you see those agreements as playing into this move towards the global corporations controlling everything?
Yeah, well, a lot of people, you know, they'll sit around and talk about the one world economy as if it's something that's coming someday. But these agreements are part of the one world economy that's happening right now, where the global economy is being merged into one giant entity. Basically, you know, here in the United States, it's and New Zealand as well, it'd be concerning, because what happens is, as the global economy is merged, well, the labor pools of all these nations are merged. And then what happens is jobs, especially good-paying manufacturing jobs, they leave areas where high wages are being paid, like the United States, and they go to places like Vietnam, where they, you know, it's legal to pay slave labor wages without all the red tape, environmental regulations, and all the rest. And so we've seen that here in the United States. At one time, the city of Detroit was the greatest manufacturing city in the history of the world, and actually had the highest per capita income in the entire country at one time. Now, of course, today Detroit is just a shell of its former self. It's a joke to the rest of the world. But on a bigger level, that's what's happening to the country as a whole. So we're seeing all these good-paying jobs leave the country. And of course, these new agreements are going to make it even worse. But then in addition to that, a lot of these new agreements are not just about economics. You know, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, basically Barack Obama has put so much of the Obama agenda in there, so much of the stuff that he couldn't ever get through Congress, he's put in there. And then once we ratify it, well, then it becomes law, and it's going to be difficult, if impossible, to ever overturn any of that. So it's kind of a giant end run around Congress that Obama has just been putting all of his goodies in there. And then what infuriates me, it's the Republicans in Congress here in the United States that have been pushing so hard to help Obama get all this through and to give him the fast track trading authority that he needed to finalize the negotiations. So I think these treaties are very insidious, but it's what the elite want, because it's moving us in the direction of a one world economic system.
Yeah, and I think here in New Zealand, well, you've mentioned Obama pushing things through. Well, the same sort of things happen here. We were just being distracted with a referendum to vote on a flag, when so many people in New Zealand are going, hang on a second, we wanted a referendum about TPPA and whether we should even be part of it. But the government very carefully sidestepped that and gave us a flag debate, which I think was a big distraction for what's happening with that. But the big concern for us here is the loss of sovereignty. Could these global corporations sue a whole country like New Zealand for take us to the cleaners? How would that affect it? Do we then lose our sovereignty, the ability to make our own laws, and are handing them over to these giant corporations? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, there's all kind of provisions in there regarding that are going to restrict our national sovereignty, whether it's the United States or New Zealand. And so, yeah, there's provisions in there where big corporations can sue a country like New Zealand and say, no, you have to do things a certain way because of the treaty and because you're going to cost us money, you're going to cost us profits. And so, you know, even if the citizens of New Zealand don't like it, well, your hands are going to be tied, you know. Here in the United States, any Buy American laws are going to be banned, where, we, you know, in the past we'd have laws about how certain things had to be made in America. Well, you know, all that's going to be banned because of these new treaties. And so, yeah, these treaties are, but they want to take our eyes off them. They've been doing it in secret. And then they bring distractions, like you mentioned, the whole flag debate down there, to get our eyes off of that. And then, of course, the media let them get away with it because, well, here in the United States, almost all the media at the very top, more than 90% of what we get through the television, the radio, the publishing houses, the video games, the DVDs, everything else, at the very top, more than 90% of all news and entertainment is controlled by just six gigantic media corporations, which in turn are owned by the elite of the world. And so, these six giant media corporations really set the agenda for what we think about, what we focus on, what we talk about with our family and friends around the dinner table, at work, at school. And so so most people are only thinking about and focusing on the things that the elite are telling them to think about and focus on.
Yeah, which to me brings me to another point. What about Agenda 2030 and Pope Francis at the UN in September sort of getting up and espousing it? To me it's Agenda 21 on steroids. Have you got any thoughts about that, how they're going to use environmental issues as a chance to ring-fence us even more?
Oh, yeah, you're exactly right, Tony. You know, most of your listeners are probably quite familiar with Agenda 21. Well, now this is the next generation. Like you said, it's Agenda 21 on steroids. And so back in September, the Pope actually, unprecedented for this to happen, he traveled from Rome to New York City to give the address, which kicked off the conference where this 2030 agenda was unveiled. And now, you know, and that's what it's called in their documents. But for public consumption, they're calling it the new global goals. And so there's 17 global goals, and they're saying we have to do this to save the planet, for the good of the children, you know, for the good of the future. We've got to take care of the earth. And all that sounds good. But then you look at these 17 global goals, and they really are a template for global governance. They represent a giant step forward toward a global system. And, and they're telling us, oh, it's just voluntary, you know. But then, you know, at this conference, essentially, virtually every single nation on the entire planet willingly signed up for these new global goals. And so a lot of the language used in these new global goals, they talk about fighting poverty, they talk about helping women, and, you know, they talk about, you know, all these good things, protecting the environment. But in the end, if you read all of it and you understand the full implications of what they're saying, it really is insidious. And in order to do everything they want to do, they really do have to have control over the entire planet. And but, you know, then that weekend they had a big concert in Central Park in New York City called the Global Citizen Festival, promoting the new global goals. All of this is just a huge, huge, huge step toward this kind of new world order that they're trying to put together, and yet very, very few people seem upset about this.
Yeah, they've put it across like it all looks good. It's bundled up to look good, but in essence, it's the opposite.
Yeah, it's all about propaganda. It's about packaging. It's about, you know, public relations. It's about selling it, you know, because they're not going to come out and say, oh, we want to bring in tyranny. We want to do this. They make it sound nice and they make it sound like it's going to be good. And we're all pulling together. We're all going to make the world a better place, you know? And so that's how it's sold. But then inside the package, it really is poison. It's quite alarming. But But that's why it's so important to have shows like yours or websites like mine where we're trying to inform the people, because we're, you know, they represent the alternative media, the portion of the, you know, just people out there that are sharing information that's not controlled by the elite. And so fortunately, more people are waking up. They're starting to listen. They're starting to think for themselves. They're starting to disengage from the propaganda matrix, I call it. And we need a lot more of that.
Yeah, and we just want to thank you once again. We're gonna sign off now. But before we do, could you just give us a little bit about what you do? Tell us what you do, and how people can subscribe to your newsletter, and just give us a bit of a rundown on who you are, what you do, and how people can get hold of you.
Sure. Well, my name is Michael Snyder, and I'm the publisher of the economiccollapseblog.com. Or if you just go to Google and type in the economic collapse, even in New Zealand, I think it should probably be the number one result that comes up. I also have a couple of other websites, endoftheamericandream.com, where I write about a broader variety of issues, and then themostimportantnews.com, where I have all my writing and other articles and guest articles and a whole bunch of news all collected together on one central location. That's themostimportantnews.com. And then if people want to find my books, my novel, The Beginning of the End, and my nonfiction book, Get Prepared Now, those are both available on Amazon.com.
Oh, that's great, Michael. Thanks for, we just want to thank you for being on the show today.
Tony and Chris, thank you guys for having me on today. I very much appreciated it. And, I definitely am glad to hear voices of liberty and freedom down in New Zealand.
Well, that was a great interview. And thank you, Michael, once again, for all of that. There's a lot of information. And, Tony, don't you agree that he's brought out a lot that that we've spoken about previously on these episodes?
Yeah, I think for me there was a lot of confirmation of much of what we've spoken about before, and it's good to hear someone else like Michael confirm basically what we're thinking.
And I think once again we need to reiterate that complacency is not where we should be at today globally. Here in New Zealand we shouldn't be complacent, and for all the listeners, wherever you are, don't be complacent at this time.
No, I think a lot of people have been thinking that wolf has been cried so many times, and so they're doing nothing, thinking, oh, this will just blow over, it'll be some little thing again. But no, I don't think so, not this time.
And preparation is the key. Once again, we urge you, if you don't have a relationship with God and through Jesus as our Savior, then that's first and foremost. And if you haven't done so, do so. Get right with God, and then you know, you can be confident in all things.
Yeah, that's bottom line, really, isn't it? We can do all the other preparation, but if our spiritual house isn't in order, we're on shaky foundations.
Yeah. Coming back to the interview, you know, we spoke Balin's, and way back in the Greek crisis, as Michael alluded to. I think New Zealand was one of the first countries to institute a bank bail-in, and they termed it the open bank resolution. You can look it up, folks. Go and look for yourself. New Zealand has got that in place where the banks, and they're all mostly Australian-owned, don't forget. So whatever happens in Australia will translate here, and it'll translate quickly when it does occur. So if there's when there's a banking collapse, I should say, New Zealand will not be set apart for any reason.
No, and of course Europe's got those laws. America's going to head for bail-ins. Canada's collapsing as well. Just, I had one thought here at the moment. Look, if people are interested to know the specifics about preparation and what they should be doing, go back and listen to A Minute to Midnight, Episode 3. We covered a whole lot of things that we believe people can do to get themselves set up and prepared for a financial collapse. So, yeah, just an afterthought. Go back and listen to Episode 3 if you've got a chance.
So on that note, Tony, it's goodbye from me.
Yeah, it's goodbye from me. And don't forget to subscribe to our A Minute to Midnight YouTube channel, and we will catch you next time.